There are some that would argue that regardless of political structure, you have to look at the economic structure of a region to get at the roots of a state's success or failure. Stephen Glane covered the Middle East at the Wall Street Journal. He now writes about global economy for the Boston Globe and elaborates on his arguments in a new book, Mullahs, Merchants, and Militants, The Economic Collapse of the Arab World. And he's also with us here in Studio 3A. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil. Good to be here.
You say in your book that the region of Iraq and the Arab states fostered one of the world's greatest civilizations. Civilization and economics is at the roots of its decades-long decline. What went wrong?
Well, it's a good point. It's important to keep in mind that the Arab world's decline is a fairly recent phenomenon when you consider the many centuries and millennia of Arab history. And I argue in the book that that if you have to look at the Arab world as it was 100 years ago, and it was essentially a borderless trading bloc with very lightly regulated, light tariffs. There is a free flow of goods and services.
Through the Ottoman Empire.
Through the Ottoman Empire, right. It wasn't until after the First World War that the colonial powers, meaning the French and the British, decided to partition the region, arguably to control it. It was the crucial land bridge between Europe and the markets of India and China. And in so doing, they took this very healthy economic bloc and they essentially traumatized it and erected barriers through the process of borders to that free flow of goods and services. And that's what had this very damaging effect on the Arab economy.
And that there's been essentially a steady decline ever since?
Well, yes. I mean, it first expressed itself just as the inconvenience of being prevented from traveling from one part of the Arab world to the other. It set up national economies where nation-states had never existed. This was a very alien construct for the Arabs. They never thought of themselves, or their identity was never interpreted in terms of nationhood. It was either ethnicity or tribe or religion. When you create a nation, you create national industries that need to be protected and subsidized, and that creates all sorts of economic dislocation and inefficiencies, as we all know, having survived the Reagan-Thatcher revolution.
As you look at the region, it was fascinating in your book that you were living in Jordan at the time, crossing the Allenby Bridge all
right.
the time to cover uprisings and violence in Israel in particular, and that you realized at one point that as you looked at the misery around you, you had absolutely no connection to the idea of this great Arab civilization that had existed in this area many years before.
That's right, and it's important to keep in mind that informs the pride and the sensibility of the Arabs even today, which is one reason that their fall from grace has been very difficult for them to take, and I think it feeds into the suspicions of Western intentions towards them.
Mm-hmm. As you talk about, obviously, in the future, as we look ahead to a new Iraqi government
right.
with in the same political structure, obviously another part of the former Ottoman Empire, you describe Iraq as the beach ball of the Middle East. What do you mean by that?
Well, pardon me. Iraq has got everything going for it. It has oil deposits, certainly, but also has water. It has a bread basket in the north in Kurdistan. It's very lush. It has a pretty good-sized market of 24 million people who, as late as the 80s, were huge consumers and had a voracious appetite for American products. It's a people who are unified, I think you could say, by their nationality to a certain extent. They're proud of being Iraqis, but that pride again goes. That pride goes back many centuries. It's hard to keep the Iraqis down, and even at the height of sanctions, when the economy was embargoed, they managed a way to survive and survive well.
Beach ball, because no matter how
you
hard
can't
you press
submerge it, you can't submerge
can't
it.
Can't keep it down. We're going to continue to talk about the role of economics in the success or failure of the nation state, in particular Iraq, with author Stephen Glane when we come back from a short break. We'd also welcome your calls, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address, TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today, we're discussing economics and the nation state, obviously in the context of the countdown to the transfer of power in Iraq. Our guest is Stephen Glane. He's the author of Mullahs, Merchants, and Militants, The Economic Collapse of the Arab World. And Professor Francis Fukuyama, who was with us earlier in the program, has graciously decided to stay with us and discuss some of the issues that we're coming up with. So he's also here with us in Studio 3A. Here are some of the stories NPR News is following today. A South Korean businessman held hostage in Iraq has been beheaded by his captors. The Korean government ordered all its civilians to leave Iraq, but reconfirmed that Korean troops will be sent to the country as planned. And Walmart, the world's largest retailer, faces the largest class action case in U.S. history. A federal judge ruled today that a lawsuit brought by 1.6 million women could proceed as a class action. More on those stories coming up later today on All Things Considered. Anyway, let's get back to our conversation about the state and about Iraq. Let's get a caller involved in the conversation as well. William is with us from Tucson, Arizona.
Yes, I have a couple of questions. For The Economist, I would like to ask if much of our problem in the Middle East, not just in Iraq, is due to the economic inequality that exists there, and whether we might not be wiser to focus on a more equal distribution of that vast wealth that exists. And for the gentleman from Cornell, I would like to ask if it's not possible, or even better, to redivide Iraq back into the separate ethnic sections that used to exist.
Basically the old Ottoman provinces. We'll take those one at a time. And Stephen Glay, did you want to address his question about the redistribution of wealth in Iraq and the importance of that, not just in Iraq, perhaps, but in Arab societies in general?
Well, I think it would be very difficult, given the lack of institutions that prevails in the Middle East today in terms of administration. I think it would be very difficult to find a credible agency that could be trusted to do just that. In terms of, there's been a lot talked about perhaps distributing Iraq's oil wealth to the Iraqi people, and given how there is a very large bureaucracy right now that may have the expertise to do it, it might be something to think about. But I can't imagine the Egyptian and the Syrian governments putting together something like that without there being a great deal of controversy.
Would you agree, Professor?
Yes, and on the question of dividing Iraq, we had touched on this earlier, but mm-hmm. I think that it's one of those things that you think about when you're, you know, think of politics as a board game and not involving real people that live in real cities, you know, all intermixed with each other. So I think that that's not a really realistic option for anyone in the future.
I'm sorry, William, we couldn't hear you. Go ahead.
If they are given true democracy, isn't it likely that we're going to it's going to result in a theocracy, at least for a period of time?
In a theocracy, in other words?
In Iraq, if they're given true democracy.
I think we got the question.
Well, you know, there are theocracies and there are theocracies. And the question really is, to what extent does the Sharia impinge on individual liberties, women's rights, and so forth? And it's possible to imagine a Islamic Republic of Iraq led by someone like Ayatollah Sistani that is not, you know, is not a terrible dictatorship the way the Khomeini regime in Iran was.
Mm-hmm. Getting back to the question of William, by the way, thanks for the call. Getting back to the questions of you were talking about the artificial borders that were drawn by the colonial powers, Stephen Glay, after the First World War, and that exist for the most part not just in the Middle East but in Africa mm-hmm. as well.
Right.
Should redrawing those borders at this point be part of the idea as we go ahead?
I don't think there's anything you can do about the borders that exist, but I would caution against trying to draw new ones, as some people have suggested for Iraq. And I think it must be said, is happening today in the Palestinian Authority. That there's a notion that somehow the Palestinian Authority today is cohesive. It's not. It's divided by checkpoints and various different areas of administration by the Israelis. And so we're going in the wrong direction by drawing new borders.
Okay, let's get another caller on the line. And this is Virginia, who's with us from San Antonio, Texas.
Right. Hi. I've enjoyed the discussion. My question is, neither of your guests have spoken about Turkey as a possible model of either, democracy or of an economic model. It is a Muslim country. The whole origins of it are different than other Muslim countries in the Middle East. It isn't an Arab country, but it is a Muslim country, and I lived there in the 60s, and I was impressed with it, and no one ever discusses it as a possible model.
Francis Fukuyama, the example of Turkey, where the army has always played, since Ataturk, a large role in enforcing certain behaviors from the civilian governments and occasionally overthrowing them.
Well, but I agree with the caller that Turkey is a tremendously positive model. You have actually the in power now a coalition led by an Islamist party, but an extremely moderate one that looks to be like a kind of equivalent, a Muslim equivalent of Christian democracy in Italy or Spain. And I would think that that has got to set a very important precedent for the Muslim world.
I would agree. And I think Turkey is moderate because the Turks are by temperament moderate. They do not want a theocracy. And I think the same could be said in general for the vast majority of Arabs. Certainly, I make the case in my book that if there was a vote tomorrow, the Islamist parties would do well, because over the years under the tyranny of Saddam and other authoritarian states, they have been allowed to organize to a certain extent. So they would do well in the initial aftermath. However, they would be restrained by the moderate impulses of the Arab people, and I think eventually they would have to appeal to that moderation.
Thank you for the call, Virginia.
You're welcome. I just want to make one point about Turkey also, that the speaker who talked about the history, and that Turkey, and I both believe firmly that democracy and the culture of democracy must come from within the country. And, of course, Turkey was not Ataturk created Turkey, and he came within and within, as opposed to having the imposition of the West on the formation of the government. That's all.
Thank you, Virginia. You mentioned if there were an election today, Stephen Glenn. Well, not an election today, but an election promised at least for January. Given the economic conditions of Iraq at this point, given the high unemployment there, the fact that so many people are out of work and that industry is suffering so much, and the previous industries seem to be floundering with the brave new world in which they find themselves, what can be done between now and the relatively short period that stretches ahead to try to stabilize Iraq economically as well as politically and in terms of security?
Well, everybody talks about security as being job one, and it is. One I think, undercover success story that the CPA can take credit for is reforming the private sector, providing an independent central bank, a treasury department, the currency exchange, which was very successful. Unfortunately, it won't be until there is stability that we'll be able to know if those institutions will work. The situation is very serious, and I think it could go either way at this point.
And given the difficulties of trying to set up entrepreneurial enterprises in a culture where certainly through the Saddam regime and the regime of the Ba'ath Party, these were the ones that existed were small.
Right, of course. But then we get back to the beach ball. The Iraqis have a very keen entrepreneurial instinct, and I wouldn't count them out. If they just have an opportunity to do business the way they've been doing it for thousands of years, they'll be all right.
Thank you both for being with us today to illuminate at least some of the problems that we're going to be talking about for the next few days, and I suspect for the next few months, and bless us all the next few years. Francis Fukuyama is the author most recently of State Building, Governance, and World Order in the 21st Century. And Stephen Glenn, thank you for your time today as well. Stephen Glenn is a former Middle East correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, now covers economics for the Boston Globe. His new book is Mullahs, Merchants, and Militants, The Economic Collapse of the Arab World. Both these authors joined us here in Studio 3A. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, which is coming to you from NPR News.